And we're back. Episode 4, Part 2. Episode 4B. If you haven't listened to Episode 4, Part 1, 4A, then, well, that's a bold move going straight in at Part 2. That's kind of cool. Well done. Are you okay? If you haven't listened to Episode 1, you should probably nip back and have a listen to that. It's probably in the same place that you found this episode. Just to bring you up to speed, in the first episode, we spoke to David Myers about the psychology of gurus, about the psychology of cult followers. We talked a little bit about the Beatles and the Maharishi, and we just touched on the Beach Boys. And in this episode, we're going to dive right back in to the 1960s. Are you ready? I'm ready. Let's go.
My main response to the world is not one of anger. As I get older, I find it's one of disappointment. What a disappointment.
I was so disappointed by the events of the day.
Everybody will be so disappointed.
So let's go back to the 60s. It wasn't just the Beatles. Everybody seemed to have their own personal guru.
Yeah, you never hear of cults now, really, do you?
Not so much.
They were very much a thing of the past, like serial killers. They've gone the way of the serial killer.
Well, there's a real sort of like entwined timeline with the rise of cults in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and the serial killers where, you know, like, you know, every other person that you met was a potential serial killer. But they are entwined, they're at the same time. You know, the cult counterculture is rising, people are turning away from religion, the kids of people who were in the first two world wars, they're kind of growing up, there's all manner of drugs kicking about, and things, society is just falling to rack and ruin, and people are turning towards, what's the answer to this? I'm afraid, I'm unhappy, I don't understand, I'm meant to be free now, I'm meant to be enlightened now, and I'm not. Somebody please tell me what to do. I think a lot of us just have an innate need to be told what to do.
Mm-hmm. By someone who seems to exude, someone who knows the answer.
Yes.
Someone who appears to have travel to the mountaintop and found the truth.
Yes.
And I can now share it with the rest of us and we'll all be fine.
Yes.
So that's what was going on, and that's what was going on. It was going on with everyone. And yeah, the Beach Boys, and Mike Love in particular, all the Beach Boys to an extent, but Mike Love in particular was a follower of Transcendental Meditation. And again, like I mentioned earlier, Paul McCartney, Ringo Starr, is to this day. Now, Mike Love is quite a divisive figure in music. He's a bit of a dick. Okay, you can't bleep that out because there's no other way to describe him.
Other opinions of Mike Love are available.
No, funnily enough, there aren't. That's a consensus.
Okay.
Apart from if you spoke to Mike Love, he would disagree with that.
Mike Love's opinion on Mike Love is available.
It is. It's in his book, which is extraordinary, which I recommend. It's one of the most self-aggrandizing books I've ever read. It's hilarious. It makes Alan Partridge's I Partridge look modest. I don't want to lay into Mike Love, even though I have just done that, because he's low-hanging fruit.
Yeah.
He's a bit of, but for good reason. Now, the reason I'm saying all that is, although he is a devout follower of Transcendental Meditation, he doesn't seem to made him any less dickish.
It's not chilled him out. It's not like David Lynch. David Lynch was like this rock of serenity.
Absolutely. Mike Love, talk about his anger, and I recommend, we'll put this in the show notes, but everyone listening, if you haven't seen it, or even if you have, go to YouTube, type in Mike Love, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame speech.
Okay.
A speech, a notorious speech in which he basically challenges the entire audience to a fight. He explicitly challenges the likes of Mick Jagger, Billy Joel, Elton John, get up on stage, the Beach Boys gonna bring you down.
80 performances last year. I like to see the mop tops match that. I like to see Mick Jagger get out on his stage and do I Get Around versus Jumpin' Jack Flash any day now. Now, a lot of people are gonna go out of this room tonight thinking that Mike Love is crazy. Well, they've been saying that for years. And I'd like to see some people kick out the jams, and I challenge the boss to get up on stage and jam. I want to see Billy Joel, see if he can still tickle ivories. Let me see. I know Mick Jagger won't be here tonight. He's going to have to stay in England. But I'd like to see us in the Coliseum and him in Wembley Stadium, because he's always been chicken shit to get on stage with the Beach Boys.
He explains in his book, or attempts to explain, that he'd been fasting for 6 days and was quite confused.
Oh, he was hangry.
He was really hangry. Hence why he opted to basically spark out Billy Joel. But it's an incredible clip. Now, we're getting away from the point now.
But if you're going to be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, have a sandwich first.
There's a sign at the entry that says that.
Have you had your sandwich?
It's known as the Mike Love Clause ever since that. But please watch it. It's so funny. So what in 1968, what they decided to do when they came back from Rishikesh, rather than denounce Maharishi as the Beatles had done, they were still on board with him, right? They still thought he's a cool guy.
Yeah.
So much so that they decided to mount a co-headlining tour with the Maharishi. 29 concerts were scheduled around America. It was abandoned after just 3 days.
Wow. That's embarrassing.
Chronic lack of interest. Obviously, that was a massive disappointment to all concerned. And the reason that happened was, you can imagine, it's 1968. Now, in America, in 1968, the Beach Boys, their fortunes were waning.
Yeah.
They were not the hit-making sensation that they had been even up until 1966.
Yeah.
Right? America's band, you know. One of the few American bands to still be hanging around when the British invasion happened. They were still having hits, number one hits, still huge. But 1968, the dream is over. Not over here in Europe, but in America. So, first of all, they weren't that popular anymore.
Mm.
Also, can you imagine going to a concert and first you have to sit through an hour of a guru giving a talk?
Yes.
You're going to be ready. You're not going to be up for that. It's not going to work.
No.
Is that you can't have those two things on the same bill. But what I think that story shows is that the Maharishi, and I don't think this is disappointing, he kind of understood showbiz.
Yeah.
He kind of, even though that didn't work, he thought, that's a good idea. That'll reach the young people.
Yes.
I'll go on tour with a rock band. And there was another guru of sorts involved in the Beach Boys story. And this is a dark tale which has been documented elsewhere, particularly in a fantastic series that you and I love, Wendy, the story of Dennis Wilson and Charles Manson.
Yes, which is wild.
And it's the podcast is You Must Remember This, hosted and written by Karina Longworth. And you can listen to that to get the full story of not just Dennis Wilson's relationship with Charles Manson, but the whole Manson family saga.
The entire Manson family saga. It's so rich. It's so well researched. And Karina's podcast is spectacular. It's called You Must Remember This, and it's about the Manson family, and we will put the links in the show notes. Andrew Hickey's 500 Songs podcast also has an episode on that relationship.
It's a Never Learn Not to Love by the Beach Boys.
Okay, so to pull it into a nutshell for the listeners, tell me about Charles Manson and the Beach Boys.
Now, Charles Manson, this is before, obviously, the Tate LaBianca murders. And so this is 1968. Those murders took place a year later, in 1969.
Mm-hmm.
Charles Manson, as I'm sure a lot of people know, was, as well as being a psychopath and cult leader, was a budding songwriter. He really wanted to break into the music business, the LA Hollywood music business. And for years he'd been punting his songs around. Now, Charles Manson was not a terrible songwriter. He was mediocre.
Yeah.
Right. His problem was that he was mediocre. Also, that there were 1,000,000,000 other mediocre hippie singer songwriters out there trying to break into the music business. So he had no chance, right?
Yeah.
But he was good at sort of ingratiating himself into people's circles, in inner circles. So he kind of made a nuisance of himself in that scene. Right, and he cannot accept at all the polite rebuffals that he's receiving are basically no's.
He's not going to hear a no.
He doesn't hear a no. Yeah. He, a bit like the character Rupert Pupkin in Martin Scorsese's The King Comedy,
yeah.
When he's politely rebuffed by Jerry Lewis at the beginning of the film, he takes that as an encouragement.
Yes.
And the fact that these people spoke to Charles Manson at all, I'm talking about producers like Terry Melcher and so on, meant that, oh, I'm in.
Yeah.
I'm in with these posts. So he's hanging around that. And by the way, I would just like to, it's an urban myth, he did not audition for the Monkees.
Okay.
That is not true.
Thank you.
He would have done had he not been in prison at the time. He absolutely would have done. And also what absolutely would have happened would he would not have been chosen.
Well, no, because he just...
look at him.
He wasn't good enough.
And also look at him.
Yes,
he's not going to be a Monkee.
Yes.
A fresh-faced boy band member.
Yeah.
That's irrelevant, but it's, you know... What is relevant, really, though, Wendy?
What is relevant?
Yeah. So, Charles Manson, basically, so one day, and by chance, two of Charles Manson's family members, as you called them, as he called his cult, the family, the young women, were hitchhiking by the side of the road, Dennis Wilson driving past in his sports car. Dennis Wilson being, he had an eye for the ladies, you can extrapolate from that what you will. He stopped and let them in and took them back to his house, and they had the...
Yeah.
One thing led to another. And then one thing, and that led to another. They were part of Charles Manson's family. They said, hey, man, Dennis, you've got to meet Charlie. Obviously, they had ulterior motives because they knew who Dennis Wilson was. Famous rock star.
Yeah.
Meet Charlie. Charlie wanted to get in the music business. Charlie also wanted money and fame.
Yeah.
And so what a short version of this is that they all ended up living in Dennis Wilson's mansion.
And Dennis Wilson ended up moving out and just handing it over to them because he was too scared to say no, to say, give me my house back.
And he was at first taken under this, but he believed that this guy, Charlie, at first was, like a lot of people, was a wise guru.
Mm-hmm.
So Dennis thought he was, you know, a pretty interesting guy.
He would have his campfires at night, you know, he'd sit there, he'd have his guitar, you know, he's playing guitars at women. And he's talking about his philosophies and stuff. And by all accounts, he's an incredibly charismatic man. But at the same time, everyone in that circle has been handed hallucinogenic drugs. I want to say it's easy to convince, and you see this with cult leaders throughout history, is that when you're A, charismatic, and B, you make the drugs very available, it's extremely easy to essentially brainwash people into believing that you have powers that you don't have.
And especially when those people have been handpicked by you because they are, in whatever way, they are vulnerable. And they are broken.
Yes.
And like all cult leaders that you mentioned there, they're all charismatic and they're also very good at spotting people who can be manipulated.
Yes. And the thing about Dennis Wilson is, and we're going to move on to Brian Wilson in a moment, but Dennis Wilson's father, Murray, he was an exceptionally abusive man. And so, you know, the Wilson brothers are incredibly vulnerable people who are looking for, again, that benevolent cosmic father, because they didn't have that growing up.
They're looking for that kindness.
Yeah.
And they're looking for the affirmation.
Yes.
That they never got from their own father.
No.
Never. They got no love and no encouragement. Their father, Murray, was himself a failed songwriter, like Charles Manson. That's the only sort of direct comparison perhaps we should make between Murray and Charles Manson. No. No, perhaps. No, let's really go for a theory I'm formulating in my head right now. But he was a failed songwriter, and he who happened to have an exceptionally gifted son, to say the least, exceptionally gifted, I would say, a prodigy, a genius. And he was jealous of his own son, mainly because his son was a genius and he wasn't, but also because his son became hugely successful in the music industry. So, of course, Murray glommed onto that. Later on, long after the Maharishi was sort of out of the picture, for Brian at least, Brian had a severe and prolonged mental and physical breakdown. And he continued to have, you know, problems throughout his life. And he died quite recently. During that Brian's worst period of illness, he was under the guidance, he was under the cosh of a therapist.
Control.
Under the complete control.
Yes.
And I mean complete control.
Yeah.
Of a therapist called Dr. Eugene Landy. Landy was a controversial figure. Landy was a psychopath. Landy was a psychopath, and Landy was someone who absolutely suffered from narcissistic personality disorder.
Now, we can't diagnose anyone, but all of the behaviours...
He ticks every single...
We can't diagnose him.
No, we can't. We can't. But I've read about him, and I've decided I'm an expert.
Okay, we've done a lot of research.
We have done a lot.
I'm sorry, I listen to this podcast about serial killers, and every time they do anything about the pathology of serial killers, they say, I'm not a psychologist, but I've done a lot of research.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we're not psychologists, but Paul really has done a lot of research.
Yeah. Eugene Landy was a therapist who was hired by the Beach Boys to look after Brian, to help Brian, because he was in dire straits, not the band, God forbid. So they hired him to, because Brian was in his bed, he was taking too much drugs, he was drinking too much, he was an alcoholic, he was an addict, he was mentally ill, and they hired him, but eventually after about a year or so, they sacked him because his prices were exorbitant and he was putting the money up all the time. This was a man who loved money, this was a man who loved to live well.
Yeah.
He had a lot of celebrity clients, including quite famous ones like Alice Cooper and various actors. But what happened when he met Brian Wilson, by the way, although they sacked him, he later reconvened with Brian in the late 70s and cut off one of the stipulations of his regime, I'm putting that in inverted commas, was that Brian must cut off all contact with his family, with his friends, with his former life. And this is what cult leaders do.
Textbook narcissist behaviour. Cut people off, isolate people from their support networks, so you have them to yourself.
You have them entirely to yourself.
Yeah.
And he had Brian entirely to himself. And what I was saying about his other celebrity clients, when he met Brian Wilson, a man with quite severe mental health issues, a very fragile man, a very vulnerable man, he realised, ka-ching, and this is not cynical or wrong to say this, this is not supposition, he thought, this is someone I can manipulate. This is someone I can completely control because they are broken. They're so broken that they are, there's nothing left of them almost.
But he's a cash cow.
He's a cash cow. He is a very, very, very rich man, Brian Wilson. So Landy cuts everyone off. He then becomes Brian's business associate. He's earning royalties from Brian's songs. He's earning royalties from songs that... Because Landy eventually has co-writing credits on some solo Brian Wilson songs in the 80s. He has a production credit on his solo album that he released in the late 80s. But he did have co-writing credits. But Landy also had royalty rights to songs he had nothing to do with. You know.
Because it's constant money coming in. The minute you've got that co-writing credit, the money's never going to stop coming
in. It's never going to stop. And he had Brian Wilson, who was, as we say, in no fit state, sign over everything, basically. Landy owned everything. Now, this is such a blatant con artist. It's quite insane to behold.
Yeah.
There is a wonderful very beautiful film about this era of Brian Wilson's life called Love and Mercy.
Love and Mercy is an absolutely incredible film with John Cusack and Paul Dano,
both playing Brian. Paul Dano plays Brian in the sort of late 60s when he's making Pet Sounds and Smile. Uh-huh. And John Cusack plays the older Brian, who's under the control of Landy, who's played ferociously and brilliantly by Paul Giamatti. What a performance.
Christ! Seriously? Seriously? You have got to learn to wait your goddamn turn! Jesus Christ! Now this is what happens, okay? No! You are not goddamn hungry, you think you're hungry! Do you understand the goddamn difference? Wait your turn!
This is just a really extreme example of how a sort of self-styled healer can completely dominate a vulnerable person.
Sorry to interrupt the show again, but we just thought we should address the point that during my conversation with David about the inner workings of cults, and they all essentially operate along the same lines, we don't mention the world's most famous and widespread cult by name. You know the one that we mean. And that, quite frankly, is because we're scared of them, and could really do without being hassled by any of their minions who may be listening. And yes, that's probably delusions of grandeur on our part, but you can't be too careful. We're also aware that by adding this bit, we've drawn attention to who we're talking about, but, well, what can you do?
It's essentially a process of grooming that's going on at that point. A gradual, calculated set of manipulations that over time increase the would-be followers' contact with the group and dependence. So there's a few stages to that. First of all, targeting and love bombing, it's known as. So the person gets attention offered to them, they're given the really warm welcome, and they get apparently unconditional acceptance offered to them by the members of the group. The next stage is about isolating that person. So they're then encouraged to be isolated from their family, from their friends, and from, over time, any belief systems which may then compete with the ideals of the group. Mm-hmm. The group then controls information. So they limit the person's exposure to external sources. So let's all go and live on this farm somewhere. Give up your phone, give up your radio, don't bring any electronic devices with you, etc.
Or in the case of sort of modern day things, don't believe what they're saying. You know, they set up this idea that the other people are lying.
Yep, don't listen to them. No debate, all these sorts of things. Don't appear in public to sort of talk about what it is that we even believe in as well. They shut themselves off and shut themselves down from external sources. Mm-hmm. They also, particularly if the groups have rather sort of out there or outlandish beliefs, such as this kind of UFO and kind of disaster cults, they invite you to suspend your disbelief. Mm-hmm. They tell you that something is going to happen. Mm-hmm. Finally, they expect the follower to escalate the level of commitment. So first of all, they ask you to give small acts of compliance. So take away this leaflet, give some money, get a ribbon and put it on your clothes, for example, and then that turns into ever escalating degrees of sacrifice and commitment, which prove that you are one of them, and at that point you're willing to do anything. It's too late, they've got you at that point.
Yeah.
The whole point of the conditioning is that deepens the control of the group. They'll use certain psychological techniques to do that. Generally what they will do is they will appeal to emotion rather than using evidence, and they do that so that they bypass traditional modes of security. They switch off your critical thinking faculties. Right.
And when you've got somebody who has experienced trauma, then they're going to have some of the language around people who've experienced trauma is that they're wired for protection.
Yes.
And not connection. And so in order to connect with someone who's experienced trauma, you have to kind of create this idea of, I'm protecting you.
Yes.
Against all of this. So I can see how that would really deepen the relationship with someone who's had that more difficult childhood.
Absolutely. And that person is then, if they have experienced trauma, they're more likely to be afraid and more likely to seek that out. So
yeah.
if you're telling them that they are under threat in some way, mm-hmm. they're more likely to stick with you because they think you'll protect them.
Yeah.
It's very insidious. And that actually takes me on to my next point, which is that then induces a kind of paranoia.
Yes.
which builds into the siege mentality of the group. So they're really enmeshing you in this situation, which mm-hmm. is making it, it's almost like a spider's web being formed around you. It's really, really difficult to get out.
Yeah.
Only you're not struggling. You know, your defences are gone.
But then so many of the cults that certainly that I've been looking at, they have levels. And so you might come in at a particular level and then you can build your way up. I mean, even if you go back to things like, you know, like cult leaders like Aleister Crowley, you know, you come in at a particular level and then you have to work your way up through almost circles until you're at the inner circle. And so at each level, you're giving away more and more money, sex, actions. And so by the time you get to the inner circle, they know that you are absolutely obedient.
Absolutely. You are a total true believer at that point.
Yeah.
And at that point, there's a kind of reduction in any sort of cognitive dissonance that might be going on. Yeah. Cognitive dissonance is what happens when you find competing ideas or ideas and actions that don't match uncomfortable. So at that point, that dissonance has reduced, and any sacrifices that you're made, you are justifying them by convincing yourself of the kind of rightness of the ideals of the group or whatever it is that they're trying to achieve.
Yeah. David, can you give us some examples of the kind of things that people can be brought to believe and how... What the mechanism is for them to come to believe some things that are really quite bizarre?
I'll do that by illustrating what I think is the, from what I've been able to find anyway, I think the kind of foundational piece of psychological research into cults. It's from a book which is called When Prophecy Fails by Festinger, who was the psychologist who came up with the theory of cognitive dissonance, and a couple of his colleagues. They actually infiltrated a UFO doomsday cult in Chicago in the 1950s, which was called The Seekers.
That's so cool. Is there a documentary about this?
I don't know. Possibly.
The
Seekers isn't the band from the 70s. what The Seekers believed, it was started by an ordinary housewife who was a medium. And she and her followers believed that much of North America and Europe was going to be destroyed in a flood before dawn on the 21st of December 1954, and that the survivors, i.e. the group, would be rescued in a flying saucer. So they've set themselves up there for failure by giving a really specific date and time.
This happens over and over again.
It happens over and over again.
We have just survived yet another...
Rapture.
Rapture, yeah. In September, October 2025. It didn't happen. And of course, you know, the world didn't end in 2012. So, yeah,
no.
Carry on, David. I'm so sorry.
What's... The psychologists theorised that when the appointed date and time passed without incident, that quite a lot of the group wouldn't simply walk off in disgust, that they would actually double down on their beliefs. And that's actually what happened. What happened was a lot of the groups had left their jobs. They gave away their money and their property in advance of the date happening. When nothing happened, those with the strongest beliefs were more steadfast in their belief, and they found ways of rationalizing the absence of the flood. So they'd prayed hard, and that averted the flood, or that there was some other aspect of their actions or behaviour which meant that the flood didn't happen and the UFO never arrived. And they went out and faced the public in ways that they hadn't been doing prior to the 21st of December 1954. Those whose beliefs were less strong or were less committed, drifted away over time, but the true believers stayed true to the belief. Why is that? Well, again, it comes back to our evolution. We are extremely social creatures.
Yeah.
We have a drive to conform. Some of the really interesting psychological research in that is really famous. Probably the most foundational is the Ash conformity experiment in 1951. And that revealed the power of what he called normative social influence. So it was an experiment with absolutely no stakes at all. The subject of the experiment would go into a room with a group of actors, and he had to identify which of three lines matched the line for length on the left-hand side of the page. Ash found that one-third of individuals would change their response to match the fake opinion given by the group.
So they would, in order to fit with the group, they would say that even though their senses are telling them that line is shorter than the others,
yep,
in order to fit in, they would lie to themselves? Or are they believing it? Or they must know.
So what, I've seen a video of it, and the first trial, if you like, everybody around the table would say, okay, which was, is it line A, B, or C, which matches the line on the left? They would all give the wrong answer. The person would give the right answer at different points within the group. But when it became apparent on the second round, which was the real trial of the experiment, everybody else in the room would give their opinion. They would say that line three, for example, matched when it was actually line B. The subject of the experiment would match the group one third of times. They would lie. They would openly say, I think it's the same line as everybody else.
Wow. In order to fit in.
That's how powerful conformity is.
Good Lord. Do not conform, people. And now, back to Paul Whitelaw. I just want to touch on some of the other things that the rock stars of the 60s, 70s and 80s were believing in, or the sort of the cults that they were sort of moving towards. So we've got Aleister Crowley and Led Zeppelin.
Yeah.
Which is definitely not a good thing.
he was heavy into the old Satanism, wasn't he, Aleister Crowley?
Yeah.
Crowley. So Jimmy Page, song thief Jimmy Page. That's on a matter of record as well.
Yes.
It was heavily... Again, it was all part and parcel of the countercultural thing of just wanting to experiment and to investigate alternative lifestyles.
Well, for that, for me, wanting to believe in Aleister Crowley and his church. There he is.
Aleister. I'm Aleister.
Aleister.
Look at him on Instagram, in judgment of you.
Oh, God, he's got such an evil face. Jimmy Page and Aleister Crowley. You know, you're not looking there at somebody who is seeking to hand over their power. Because obviously, by this point, Aleister Crowley's long dead. He's looking at that to, I would suggest, increase his own power over other people.
Page's.
Yeah.
Well, he's all... Yes, he is. So he's... At that point in the 1970s, he's already got wielding a huge amount of power, mm-hmm, over his audience. Because,
yeah,
he is, you know, the term rock god, it wasn't coined for him.
No.
But it was coined sort of in the 70s. There weren't really rock gods, yeah, as we think of them now. So these people were gods on earth.
He's a phenomenally talented man.
He is. He's amazing.
But he takes this detour into sort of Golden Dawn...
Satanism.
Yeah, stuff. Well, I suppose that increases your kudos, makes you look a bit cooler.
It is, because, you know, the devil's got all the best tunes and all of that. And sorry, Jesus, but the devil, Satan's cooler.
We'd like to end this episode now with a few more words from Dogo, our Zen Buddhist priest. Dogo, throughout the conversations we've been having on this subject, one of the recurring ideas is that you should always be wary of anyone who presents themselves as an all-knowing guru who can magically solve all your problems. Just watch out for anyone who puts themselves on a pedestal like that.
If anyone idealises me, and they have, I mean, the a lot of people will project onto spiritual teachers. And I mean, I was disturbed a long time ago when I realised that there were happily married couples who would have gotten divorced if I'd told them to, because I must be right. Which means that they did not understand my teachings at all. They had no idea what Zen Buddhism was. So if anybody made the mistake of idealising me, I would want to let them down. I would want them to see all of my flaws, because what you project onto the perfect teacher is poisonous. You know, I mean, we take medicine and turn it into poison if we do that.
What is it about people who are drawn to the role of guru, who want to inhabit that idealized superhuman God on earth role? What is it that they want when they try to become that guru for other people?
I think it really is the same thing that motivates people who want fame in other fields, you know, whether it's music or any other art form. When you're seeking fame, well, really you want, there's money and there's sex. It really comes to, and it's really difficult to think of, I find it impossible to imagine any power scenario that's not based on that, you know, acquisition of money and sex.
So many people set themselves up as yoga teachers, meditation teachers, gurus, and then abuse, when actually the core of what people are drawn to is so good. What are people looking for when they come to Buddhism, yoga, meditation, etc.? And if they're in a good situation with good people, what will they find?
I think, well, first, if they find an unsafe teacher, if they find somebody who wants something from them, then they'll collude in their own exploitation.
Can you expand on that thought? Collude in their own exploitation. What do you mean?
Well, so many people turn towards spiritual practices, really wanting God on earth, or I would say really wanting a perfect parent they never had, you know, someone to run the life for them, you know, someone to solve all the problems. And what I love about Zen Buddhism is that we absolutely guarantee not to solve a single problem. You know, what we can do is show you how to relate to things that you thought were problems. Now, it still be problems, but they also might not be. But I think if you're looking for, when you find yourself, you're looking for this cosmic parent, and you're looking for this perfect person to run your life for you, a good teacher will find ways to turn that back on you, to hand that responsibility back to you, and refuse to give you easy answers. But easy answers sell, and so many people want to sell things. When it becomes about, when you can tell that a teacher is toxic, is exploitative, is not just in the teacher's behaviour, but when their disciples or their followers will say things like, well, you know, the reason my teacher has sex with the students is to enlighten them, you know, and the reason we have to turn over our lives to that teacher and all our money is because, well, they're going to save us.
I want to end this episode with a thought that was shared with me by a good friend recently. I was talking to her about this episode, the themes that we were going to look at, how we were going to try to sensitively look at what takes someone into a cult or into the arms of a guru who perhaps doesn't mean well. And my friend said something very, very wise. And it's something I wish I'd heard 20 years ago, 30 years ago. And she said simply this: never trust anybody who tells you that they can fix you. God almighty, Chris, that's just weird and creepy. Yeah. Thank you so much for listening to So Disappointed. We'd like to thank David Myers, our resident psychologist. We'd like to thank Dogo Stevenson, Zen Buddhist priest, writer, poet, meditator, and just phenomenal communicator. And we'd like to thank our co-creator and co-writer Paul Whitelaw for his encyclopedic knowledge of the 1960s and 70s. And we'd like to thank you for coming back. Please, 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 if you like the show, leave us a review. Give us some stars. Tell your friends. If you've got a disappointment that you'd like us to share on the show, please contact us on Instagram at So Disappointed Pod or on Blue Sky at So Disappointed. You can find our website at sodisappointedpod.com. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at sodisappointedpod@gmail.com. Join us next time as we ask, why does nobody care that aliens seem to actually exist? Shouldn't our minds be utterly blown? Why are we so ambivalent towards the extraterrestrials?